From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The Trump administration scored a victory today in its fight against a Chinese telecom giant. Huawei will no longer have access to updates for Google's Android operating system. It's a response to the administration's order last week that U.S. companies stop doing business with Huawei for national security reasons. U.S. officials believe the Chinese government will use Huawei's equipment to spy on foreign countries. But can anything slow down Huawei's ambitions around the globe? Clint Finley is contributing writer for Wired magazine. He joins us now. Clint, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So it sounds like with this news that Google is severing ties with Huawei and limiting its access to the Android operating system, that the Trump administration's fight against the company is working.
Yeah, at least for now. It's worth pointing out that this might blow over depending on how Huawei handles it, what sort of demands the U.S. government makes.
Is it a blow to Huawei?
Oh, absolutely. Their handset phones are mostly dependent on Android, if not entirely dependent on Android. They'll still be able to use the open source version of Android, but that lacks Gmail, a number of Google-branded applications, probably most importantly, the Play Store, which means people won't be able to download a lot of the apps that they're used to downloading for Android.
Well, Huawei is this giant seller of telecommunications equipment around the world, and it's leading this race to build infrastructure for the next generation of wireless technology. It's also known as 5G. People might recognize that. But before this fight with the Trump administration, I'm willing to bet that most Americans really had never heard of the company, or at least didn't know what the company did. How wide is Huawei's reach around the world?
It's funny. It's practically everywhere except the United States. It's by far the largest telecommunications company in the world. They started in China, but they're all over Europe. They're in Mexico, Canada, a lot of Africa, other Asian countries apart from China. They have an extremely global reach at this point.
And what exactly are they doing in these countries to establish that the 5G network?
So the big part is building the equipment that goes into cell towers, essentially. So in the case of 5G, that's involving new networks that use smaller cells instead of the big towers that we're used to. The big towers will also be a part of 5G. So they build a lot of the equipment that goes into data centers that connect cell towers together and that sort of thing.
The Trump administration is also trying to limit Huawei's global influence by asking its allies, like the United Kingdom, to stop using the company for these purposes, to build these 5G networks. Do you think that the U.S. political pressure will be able to slow Huawei down?
Well, so far it hasn't had as big an effect as the U.S. had wanted it to. The European Union, the United Kingdom had both not really gone along with the U.S.'s pressure to dump Huawei. They were putting some new safeguards in place to take a closer look at Huawei's technology as they build out 5G networks, but weren't willing to throw Huawei out entirely. But now with what the U.S. is doing now, restricting U.S. companies from selling or providing technology to Huawei, that could have a significantly bigger impact on Huawei's future.
Is there any proof that countries using Huawei's networks would be vulnerable to espionage by the Chinese government, which is what the U.S. government believes?
So far, there isn't any proof that's been made public. Huawei actually filed a lawsuit recently against the U.S., arguing that they were being unfairly targeted because there's no evidence that they've done any spying. So essentially, they were asking the U.S. to essentially put up and shut up. Regarding the spying allegations. So if there's any proof, they're asking the U.S. to bring that out into the lawsuit. So at the moment, there's no proof that they have done that, though the technical capabilities are there, especially since they are a company that's subject to the laws of China.
So if Huawei is building the next generation of internet connectivity around the globe, as you've described, who's going to do that in the United States if Huawei's persona non grata here?
So far, it's been built by companies like Ericsson and Nokia and U.S. companies as well, companies like Cisco that provide some of the other components that are necessary.
But are they far behind?
It depends on how you measure. There are some reports out there saying that China is ahead of the U.S., but it's really early on both sides at this point.
All right, that's Clint Finley, contributing writer for Wired magazine. Clint, thanks very much.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
Well, to Atlanta, where graduates of the all-male, historically black college Morehouse were stunned yesterday when commencement speaker billionaire Robert F. Smith said this.
Now, I've got the alumni over there, and this is a challenge to you, alumni. This is my class, 2019. And my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
And that's about $40 million. Peter Wilborn was one of those graduates. Peter, it looked as if people had a hard time grasping this.
Yes, it was almost surreal. We were sitting there at the commencement address and we didn't know what to think of it simply because so many of us had lived with the idea of student debt that it was just given as a fact of life. But when he announced it, suddenly a lot of that just went away. And we realized that we could primarily focus on what we loved and what we had studied for so many years now.
But yeah, but it took a second to get there. People are like, what? What did he say? And,
right.
Yeah. And we know that some of these debts of your fellow students are pretty high. Full-time tuition at Morehouse is a little over $25,000. But then you've got room and board and books and fees. It's, you know, maybe about $48,000. More than 90% of the students there get some form of financial aid. And we're reading of people with, you know, they had debt approaching $100,000. You seem a little luckier in that way. What was yours?
Mine was around $14,000. And yes, I was very lucky. I ended up having to take some out as one of the scholarships I had ran out. So I decided to take out a couple of loans and I was fully planning on paying them back in a couple of years. But yes, I was a little more fortunate than some of my classmates.
But still, $14,000 is $14,000. So, you know, nothing to sniff at. What does this change for you? You know, in addition to having this burden off your head, what does it change the way you may approach going forward?
Well, a lot of the things that my classmates and I have been talking about over the past 24 hours was how this sets a new bar for excellence, not just for the college, but for ourselves as well, how much we have to give back to not just Morehouse, but the educational community as a whole.
By the way, when you mentioned you took out loans, the Center for American Progress researched this. Black students are far more likely to take out student loans than their white peers. And nearly half of those who borrow default on those student loans. This is the African-American borrowers. But what do you think of those who say, this was generous, how wonderful for you? But I'm looking at a quote from Anand Giridharadas, whose book is Winners Take All. He's a critic of this kind of large-scale philanthropy because he says a gift like this can make people believe that it's billionaires' jobs to take care of our problems and that we should be focusing on, you know, why there is the problem of student debt and the subprime crisis. You know, not rely on a billionaire to fix it, but to eliminate it, you know, eliminate the problems of such high debt for students. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, speaking from recent experience, I would say that all help is welcome.
Right.
But I do believe it's a collective effort. I mean, you have people that have a lot of assets that want to help you, especially one that's a member of, in this case, the black community, then in this case, we should absolutely take it. But then even those who aren't necessarily billionaires or millionaires, but can give a little here and there and support the generations that come after us, that is what's important.
Well, as part of that effort, making policy changes, because we know that the Democratic candidates are talking about this. Senators Harris and Booker have signed on to that debt-free college legislation idea. Bernie Sanders, of course, behind that. Elizabeth Warren has called for funding to help historically black colleges in particular. How much would you like to see this happen on the policy end?
As an HBCU grad, it's something that I would like to see more and more candidates approach, especially working with students and talking to them and getting firsthand accounts of what can we do to change this that hasn't been done already, and how can we make sure that they can sustain themselves going on in the future?
Yeah. And what about Robert Smith? You knew who he was. You tell us that you had researched him, knowing he was going to be the commencement speaker. One of the richest people and definitely the wealthiest African-American in America, worth $5 billion. He founded Vista Equity Partners, which is an investment company. First of all, has a great return, but it also has unconventional hiring. He doesn't seek out people with Ivy League degrees or go to Silicon Valley. He bought up the homes of Martin Luther King, Morehouse grad, and his family to donate them back to foundations. Your sense of this man?
Whew, that's actually a pretty good one. He didn't have to do this at all, and yet he did. This is a fairly large class from Morehouse as opposed to the past couple of years. And the fact that he wanted to pay off all of our student debt, that means that he has a specific understanding of who we are, what the college is, the legacy of the college, and the legacy of the students.
Peter Wilborn, one of nearly 400 men who graduated from Morehouse College yesterday and learned from their commencement speaker that he, Robert Smith, would be paying off their debt. Peter, thanks so much for talking to us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
The average American household creates more than 11 pounds of garbage every day. The cereal boxes, the yard clippings, the empty bottles of laundry detergent, they all add up to create a mountain of waste, 262 million tons of it across the country each year. But what if that number got closer to zero? Could it? Bea Johnson is trying. She joins us now from Marin County, California. She's author of Zero Waste Home, The Ultimate Guide to Simplifying Your Life by Reducing Your Waste. Bea, welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I've seen pictures of you holding a small glass jar with trash inside it. Is that really the totality of the garbage that your household creates every year?
It sure is, and we've been doing so since 2008, and it's really not as complicated as people might think it is.
So how in the world do you do that?
It's all about following my methodology of five rules. The first one is to refuse what we do not need. So we've simply learned to say no to promotional freebies, junk mail, samples, free gifts, or swag bags. The second rule of a zero waste lifestyle is to reduce, and that means letting go of all the things you do not truly use or need in your home. When you let it go, you make it available to the community, and it boosts the secondhand market, which is very important for the future of zero waste. Mm-hmm. The third rule is to reuse, and we reuse by having swapped anything that is disposable for a reusable alternative. So we've swapped paper towels for rags, paper napkins for cloth ones. There is really a reusable alternative on the market for anything that is disposable. And we also buy secondhand if we need to buy something. Now, the fourth rule is to recycle, but it's to recycle only what we cannot refuse, reduce, or reuse. So at the end of the day, the zero waste lifestyle does not encourage you to recycle more, but less by preventing waste from coming into your home in the first place, and that's done with my first 3 years.
Well, I was going to ask you, are you completely plastic-free then, or are you okay with sending some products to the recycling bin when you're done with them? Does that count?
There is one recurring piece of plastic that goes in there, and that's my husband's contact lens solution.
Uh-huh.
He has very bad eyes, so he needs to wear contact lenses and glasses on top. But this is something that he has to purchase. Mm. And indeed, when you adopt a zero waste lifestyle, your plastic consumption is extremely reduced.
The fifth R, I believe, is rot, which would be composting, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so that's a key part of this as well. But why are you doing this? Like, were you ever just like the rest of us who just tossed their trash into the garbage can?
Of course I was. I did not grow up this way. I came to the U.S. as a French au pair a long time ago. But I adopted the American way of life and with all the disposables that it comes with it and the overconsumption. But over time, I felt something was dying inside of me. It was not really bringing me any joy to be consuming so much. And I also missed the life that we had known in the big European cities that we had lived in. We had lived in London, Paris, Amsterdam, where we were used to walking and biking everywhere. So we decided to relocate to be closer to a town so we could have amenities within walking or biking distance. During that year that we discovered the advantages of a simple life. Mm. All of a sudden, we had more time for friends, family, etc. And it's thanks to that simplicity that we also found time to read books and watch documentaries on environmental issues, which made my husband and I sad thinking about the future that we as parents were creating for our children, and that's what gave us the motivation to change.
Can we do something of a lightning round here? I want to learn more about your techniques. So quickly, on each one of these, how do you handle buying big-ticket items like appliances or electronics?
We only buy really what needs to be replaced. And if that breaks, then we get it repaired. I've had my stove repaired 11 times. And actually, it was a nightmare to get it repaired because after those 11 times, it dawned on me that maybe it was the repairman that was not good. So, you know, he kept saying that it was my machine, but then we changed the repair company and then that guy came once and we haven't had a problem since.
You mentioned your husband's contact solution, but what about other toiletries, cosmetics, things like toothpaste?
There are some items that we've simply realized we didn't need. For example, shampoo, shaving cream, conditioner. We use a bar of soap. It's not a shampoo bar of soap. It's not a special bar of soap. It's just a generic type bar of soap that we use to wash our hair, our faces, our bodies. And my husband and the kids also use it to shave. So it's one product that has eliminated four others.
Going out to eat.
Well, we believe that buying is voting, just as eating out is voting. If you go to a fast food restaurant, it's a way for you to invest your money in those businesses. It's a way for you to say that you're okay with disposables and you wish of a world filled with disposables. And of course, more disposables will be created. So when we eat out, we choose a restaurant that is sit down, that serves real food on real plates with real flatware in real glasses.
What about presents around the holidays or birthdays?
That's an easy one. We give the gift of experiences instead of things. And it's important to also ask your friends and family to give you the gift of experiences, be proactive on that and let them know early on that you've adopted a zero-waste lifestyle and that you no longer accept the gift of stuff.
Well, aside from the presents, how do you get your kids on board with something like this? Because it sounds like that might be a challenge.
Well, you know, kids have very simple needs, and as long as those needs are met, they're happy. It's actually the parents that complicate those needs. The kids don't have credit cards. It's the parents that do. The parents are the ones that consume and buy the brands and, will buy whatever the kids are asking. And we actually were 6 months into it with an unpackaged pantry when I realized that my kids had not noticed that we were zero waste. It's not zero waste is not a term that we had been using. It's just that I adopted a simpler lifestyle in our household. I was the one bringing the totes and jars to the grocery store. And I realized that zero waste is more what you do outside the house. It's the person that consumes for the household that has the choice to, one, either not consume, or two, consume differently by buying food unpackaged or the necessity secondhand. And since I was the one making those decisions, zero waste actually went completely unnoticed.
What does this mean for your budget? Does it cost more to live this way?
No, it's actually quite amazing. We've found that we're saving 40% on our overall budget. This is due to the fact that, one, we consume way, way, way less than before. And if we buy something, it's only to replace what needs to be replaced. And when we buy that replacement, we buy it secondhand, which obviously costs less. But we also buy our food unpackaged. When you buy something that is packaged, 15% of the price or more is going to cover the cost of the packaging. So when you buy unpackaged, you make automatic financial savings. But best of all, we've replaced anything that is disposable for a reusable alternative. So that means that we're no longer throwing our money away. The savings are such that they've allowed us to install solar panels on our roof and a gray water system, which reuses the water from the showers and washes. So zero waste is a gift that keeps on giving.
Wow. I've been on the road touring landfills and trash incinerators and talking to people about managing the mountains of waste that cities around the world create every single day. It is such a vast and complicated problem. Do you feel like you living like this really makes a difference?
We've shown that it makes a difference. You know, when we started, the term zero waste was only used to describe waste management practices at a city level. It was also a term used in the manufacturing world, but it was not a term used to describe something you do at home. But yet, when I saw that term, it gave me a goal. But there were no books, no blogs, no guide on how to eliminate trash at home. So I had to test a lot of things. We tested a lot of extremes, but eventually we found a balance that worked for us. But, when we first exposed our lifestyle to mainstream, we just got hammered with criticism because mm-hmm. people did not know what zero waste meant. Now, of course, it's a term that is that has gone mainstream, but back then it wasn't. So people said it was disgusting what we were doing to our children because we were depriving them of the good life because we were not taking them to, you know, the fast food restaurant.
Wow.
And people laughed at us and they said, well, what you do doesn't matter. You're just one family. You won't change anything. Well, we've proven them wrong. Over time, we've been able to inspire a global movement.
If somebody listening to this is not willing or not able to go as far as you have with your family, but they still kind of want to cut back on some of the waste in their lives, what is the first thing that you would recommend?
Of course, we don't expect anyone to, and I'm not even here to tell anyone to live this way. We're only here to talk about experience. If it inspires people, great. If it doesn't, too bad. But it's, I think it's very important to adopt change in a sustainable manner, meaning that whatever change you adopt, you have to see yourself doing it for life, because then that's when it becomes a lifestyle. You can go grocery shopping with a kit of reusables very easily. It might be weird at first to get a weird look, but I explained my whole technique in the book. You don't look at them in the eyes when you present your jar at the meat counter for the first time. Just pretend as if you've done this your whole life and they won't turn you down. It's foolproof.
Bea Johnson, author of Zero Waste Home, the ultimate guide to simplifying your life by reducing your waste. She can fit all of the garbage she's created in her home over the course of a year in a glass jar. Bea, thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
Pedestrian and bicyclist deaths have been on the rise in many cities, which has led officials in Washington, D.C. to bring back a tried and true method to teach the next generation how to stay safe. Jordan Pasquill from member station WAMU reports.
Thomas Elementary's playground looks like a lot of schools. There are slides and monkey bars. But look down at the asphalt all around it, and you'll see a paint job that's fun and functional. It's full of traffic markings. Kids are navigating roundabouts and bike lanes, speed bumps, and crosswalks. In March, school officials cut the ribbon on what they call a traffic garden.
1, 2, 3.
It's a section of the playground that mimics the complicated streets of the nation's capital.
It is the city in miniature.
That's Ellen Drogan Rogers, a George Mason University professor. She helped coordinate the project and write the traffic safety curriculum.
And I'm sure during free play and recess time, when there are lots of kids out here, it will simulate the traffic of the city pretty well.
The traffic garden idea started in Europe. It reached peak popularity in the 1980s, with more than 3,500 worldwide. The idea fell out of fashion in the decades since, but now it's starting to come back. 2 Washington, D.C. schools have them, and more are on the way across the region. Fanula Quinn is a civil engineer. She runs Discover Traffic Gardens, a business that works with kids to design the projects.
So we sort of went through the whole, how do you plan, design, build, get approvals.
Now that it's built, George Mason University professors will observe kids to see how they learn best. Carly Fisher Maltese is one of those professors. She says some kids learn just by reading, but
then our more kinesthetic learners, maybe that kind of learning, you know, takes place more out here where they actually get to put it into practice.
Kids ride balance bikes and learn concepts like who has the right of way, how to stop and watch for others.
I know with my own young children, they don't quite understand the safety, and then you put them on wheels and you're like, ah! So I think this is going to do a real service to the families and the community too.
And since there's no real traffic,
it gives them an opportunity to practice and make mistakes in a safe way.
A $150,000 grant from the District Department of Transportation funded 2 newly installed traffic gardens and the curriculum. Many jurisdictions in the region have committed to eliminating traffic deaths and serious injuries. The effort is known as Vision Zero. Here's District Transportation Head Jeff Marudian at the ribbon cutting.
Projects like these are important because we know that children are among the most vulnerable users of the roadway.
Children are less likely to be seen by drivers and more often seriously injured by vehicles than a larger adult. Nationwide, kids under 18 made up the highest percentage of pedestrian traffic deaths. District officials hope more people will walk and bike in the future to take the strain off roads, but people will only do that if they feel safe. The bulk of the Vision Zero effort goes towards creating better infrastructure, like more protected bike lanes and roads with slower speeds.
But some of the other really important pillars are evaluation, education, and enforcement.
Greg Billing, director of the Washington Area Bicyclists Association, has wanted traffic gardens in the area for years.
We can all remember learning the traffic rules in driver's ed, but you're 16. You're using the transportation system from day one.
Supporters of the project say the traffic garden lessons get kids familiar with safety and learning how to be a responsible road user before they jump on their first bike or get the keys to their first car. For Here and Now, I'm Jordan Pascal.
Polls closed last night in India after a 39-day voting marathon in the world's largest democracy. Results will be in later this week, but exit polls over the weekend suggest Prime Minister Narendra Modi's right-wing Hindu nationalist BJP party will win. And this would give Modi another five-year term in office. For the country's more than 170 million Muslims, that may not be good news. Muslims make up 14% of the population in the majority Hindu country. They've faced discrimination ever since independence from British rule and the creation of Muslim Pakistan. But many say that under Modi, violence against Muslims has gotten much worse. Rana Ayub is an independent journalist in India who's been following this story. And Rana, with Modi's party, the BJP, likely now to stay in power, how are the country's Muslims feeling today?
Well, the Indian Muslims have been living in fear and apprehension, especially over the last 5 years, when there has been a lynching almost every second week in the country in the name of alleged beef consumption. Their religious identities have been attacked. Mosques in India have been destroyed. So there has been a culture of hostility. Muslims have been at the receiving end. And now that Narendra Modi, the exit polls suggest that he would have won another majority, this could be seen as a mandate to kind of amplify that kind of hate against Indian Muslims. So Muslims are worried because the next 5 years, because Modi has got a majority again, it could get worse for them.
Could you explain what's behind this rise in Hindu nationalism over the last couple of years that people say is to blame for a lot of the violence against Muslims?
So you have to understand that Narendra Modi comes from a province called Gujarat, where India witnessed one of the worst genocide of Muslims in 2002, where 1,000 Muslims were killed under his watch. And he has always been seen as a Hindu right-wing leader who has returned the Hindu pride to Indians. Mm-hmm. There has always been a schism between Indians and Muslims since the partition of India, wherein the Indian right-wing believes that Muslims should be treated as second-class citizens and their rightful place belongs in Pakistan. Narendra Modi's ideological backing is from the same organization, the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is the ideological fountainhead of the party. So he has been brought in, he has been made the prime minister because there's a good majority of this country which still believes that Modi brings the Hindu pride back, it's the Hindu majoritarian sentiment back. So that's one of the reasons that he enjoys that kind of popularity.
And just to add some context to those riots in 2002 in Gujarat, Modi was cleared of any complicity in that violence. The Supreme Court investigated and he was cleared. But what has his response been over the years to people who are saying that he's helped stoke these flames? Is he acknowledging this whatsoever?
To be fair, Modi was never cleared of the charges because he was never made an accused by the special investigative team. That Modi never got examined by the special investigations team is a travesty of justice. I mean, when I went undercover, and that's my book, Gujarat Files, is about going undercover for 8 months and doing a sting operation on all the top officials under Narendra Modi. They all confessed to his role in the Gujarat riots in aiding and abetting and ensuring that help did not reach innocent Muslims. And even when he was questioned by a foreign journalist as recently as 2013, he referred to his regret as the same regret. And he gave an analogy of that, He felt the same regret that one would feel at the killing of a puppy. Hmm. So, you know, that's a sentiment he has for Muslims.
What more can you tell us about these vigilante groups that are going around looking for Muslims and accusing them of slaughtering or eating cow, which of course is a sacred animal to Hindus? How widespread is that?
Well, it's increasingly widespread. And one of the reasons for that is that the government has emboldened these cow vigilantes. The first lynching happened in 2015 when a mob gathered and killed Muhammad Akhlaq, a Muslim man. And later, one of the members of the ruling party went and paid a visit to the accused family. Hmm. When one of the accused died later, his body was covered with the national flag. And in the lynchings that happened later, one of the union ministers in Modi government, the civil aviation minister, honored those people who were lynching Muslims in the name of consuming beef. Now, beef is banned in India. So there are rumors that spread on WhatsApp, they spread on Facebook that, you know, there's a Muslim family which is consuming beef, and then a mob gathers and they attack Muslims on the basis of this rumor. So, and there is just nothing that the government has done to stop this menace of lynching. Just about 3 weeks ago, a Muslim man was lynched in the northeastern state of Assam. And instead of arresting the accused, the police, the cops arrested the man who was lynched and took him into detention. So that's the state of law and order, which is why the lynchings continue.
Total impunity. It sounds like complete impunity.
It is complete impunity, which is why the lynchings are increasing in frequency almost every month. The hate crime data in India said that the hate crimes against Muslims have increased by 90% since Mr. Modi assumed power in 2014.
Wow. So you're a journalist and you're writing about all of this, but you are also a Muslim yourself. What's your experience been like?
Right. Well, in my country, of course, my persecution has not just been because I've been a critic of the ruling dispensation and I've been doing investigations of the government. It's also because I'm an outspoken Muslim woman. So there's misogyny, of course, and of course the fact that how dare a Muslim woman speak. So yes, each time I write something on Twitter, government officials themselves have called me Jihadi Jane. Mm. On social media. I mean, every investigation that I do is seen from the prism of my faith about being a Muslim and not just as a journalist. My work by a majority of the country ends up getting judged as a Muslim and not as a journalist. So that's the predicament, you know, you face. My recent column in Washington Post, a lot of hate was spread in India after the Washington Post piece got published, saying that I was a Muslim who was trying to defame India on international platforms. So that's what it is for privileged Muslims like me. You can understand what it is like to be a lower middle class or middle class Muslim or common Muslim in today's day and age in India.
I mentioned that Muslims make up 14% of the population in India, and yet they have just 4% representation in parliament. It's the lowest it's been in decades. Is there no opposition party that is standing up to this violence or any sort of political movement that is trying to address this?
Well, India has 190 million Muslims, and the ruling party did not have a single Muslim parliamentarian from the government or from the party who represented the Indian Muslims in the parliament. And the opposition party, the chief opposition party, the Congress itself has been accused of apathy towards Muslims. Even the tally of the Muslim candidates in the Congress is abysmally low. And there is a regional party called the AIMIM, which is a very regional party led by a Muslim leader, but it does not enjoy the kind of popularity that the Indian National Congress led by Rahul Gandhi, the Gandhi family, does. But unfortunately, the Gandhi family too has turned a blind eye to the concern of Muslims in India. And so Muslims right now are crushed between a majoritarian BJP and the Liberal Congress, and both actually have no concern for the Indian Muslim, which constitute about 170 million of the population.
When India was split into two, this partition, of course, a huge monumental moment in the history of the country, created a majority Muslim Pakistan and a secular majority Hindu India. And the idea at the time was that India would be inclusive for all religions.
Right.
Is it your sense that that vision has been lost somewhere along the way?
Well, now that the exit polls are clear that Mr. Modi is all set to return as the Prime Minister of India, despite despite the fact that minority voices were stifled in the last 5 years, and despite the fact that the country suffered the worst unemployment, and despite all of this, the country has voted him back to power, shows that the very basis of Indian democracy and the principles, the secular principles of Indian democracy, are being demolished every day. The soul of Indian democracy is being crushed because India was never meant to be a Hindu state. India was meant to be an inclusive state where Hindus, Muslims, Christians, lower caste, they all coexist. But unfortunately, we are heading into an India wherein there is a Hindu supremacist idea which basically wants to rule the country and where it wants to treat every other minority in the country as second-class citizens. This is no longer the country envisaged by our founding fathers.
Rana Ayub, an independent journalist based in India, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Also, we've reached out to the Prime Minister's office to request a response to some of the criticisms that Rana has lobbed. We received only an automated response, but a BJP spokesperson did tell Al Jazeera that the party does not discriminate based on caste, religion, or color.
If you are a Game of Thrones fan and were tied up somewhere last night, not allowed to see the finale, spoiler alert. Game over. I'm sure no one said that yet. After 8 years of epic battles, palace intrigue, grisly deaths, the Red Wedding, HBO's Game of Thrones ended last night, and not since The Sopranos has there been such a hue and cry. As of this morning, a Change.org petition to reshoot Season 8 with competent writers had more than 1.2 million signatures. Oh, and there was that last gaffe, the plastic water bottle in a scene. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So there will be spoilers here. Spoilers that will spoil things.
Many spoilers.
Spoiling things for people. Okay, so here it comes. In the finale last night, the show's iconic Daenerys Targaryen, the mother of dragons, is stabbed in the heart by her nephew and lover Jon Snow. Her dragon, in his grief, melts the Iron Throne everyone has coveted. Frankly, I felt so sorry for the dragon. I got very sad
yeah.
there. USA TV critic Kelly Lawler called it a disaster ending that fans didn't deserve. Derek Thompson, you say what?
I have seen every episode of this show. I think it's extraordinary, especially its first 4 or 5 seasons. I thought the final season was often gripping, but I agree with the critics who say the pacing was just utterly bizarre. There were scenes of pointless hobnobbing that would go on for minutes and minutes, and then enormous plot points. You know, Dany, the female lead, suddenly becoming a villain, or the crowning of a new king that we'd been waiting hundreds of hours to see. These moments took place over the course of seconds. And, you know, I was thinking, this might be the last conventional television show ever. The last time we ever have a population the size of a major state, 20 million people, watching and reacting to a TV show at the exact same time, the way we often do with live sports. And this finale felt to me like watching a Game 7 where there are long, boring stretches, and then in the fourth quarter, the best player is suddenly ejected by the refs for no reason whatsoever. Like, that's dramatic, but it doesn't give you the catharsis that you want from a Game 7. It doesn't give you the momentum that you need to understand why what is happening is happening.
Well, that,
so it just felt rushed to me in
that regard.
And
those stretches might be Peter Dinklage's character just wandering around,
looking
at the ruins, wandering and wandering. Look, I'm completely faking this here. I have seen a few episodes. I watched last night. But I'm binge watching This Is Us. So, and plus, Les Miserables was on. But Peter O'Dowd, you are one of those millions of devoted viewers that Derek just mentioned. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, like Derek, I have watched every single one of these episodes. I was ready for this to be over, to be honest. I think after 8 years, it was just time for it to wrap up.
And I was
glad that, yes, I didn't have to watch it again. I won't have to watch it next Sunday. But I think there were some tender moments in that final episode. You know, I'll never forget Peter Dinklage's character on that in the pile of rubble. He sees his brother, Jaime Lannister, and his hated sister in the pile underneath the rubble. I thought that was a really powerful scene. But the pacing was strange because in the last... As soon as the new king was branded, there was a long period of denouement, right? I mean, there was all these storylines that we had to wrap up. And I thought the last 30 minutes of the show just sort of kind of went on and on.
Yeah, Derek, talk about the last scene and this idea of the Council of Survivors. Spoiler alert, momentarily deciding, well, maybe we'll take a vote on who should now rule But no, that they laughed off the idea of democracy. By the way, look for the water bottle in that scene. One of the headlines was, congrats on inventing the Electoral College. Were they trying to, what was your thoughts on that?
So this is a scene where some of the most important characters from the previous seasons, essentially, initially it looks like they're going to execute the hand of the king and then somehow the hand of the hand of the queen, and then somehow Tyrion convinces them to make Bran the king of the Seven Kingdoms, the Six Kingdoms, and then make him the hand again.
Spoiler
this, of course, spoiler alert, of course, this happened not over the course of several minutes, but over the course of several seconds.
Right.
And I would say several things. First of all, Bran the Broken, a little bit of an absurd name, a little bit ableist, but I think they needed to do more to establish Bran in this season. If he's ultimately going to sit on the proverbial Iron Throne, maybe give him more than one line per episode?
Well, in the whole series, really. I mean, he vanished for long periods of time throughout the entire 8 years.
Well, didn't
say
anything last night either.
Yeah, he had
one line, maybe two lines. Like, again, people had been waiting so, so long to hear who was finally going to sit in the throne, who was going to rule over these kingdoms. And it goes to a character who's so laconic, he only says about four words in the scene in which he becomes the king.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that fans are upset because they were expecting more meaning from this season, more explanation, more of a buildup, so they could feel like when the biggest moments they'd been waiting for were happening, they were cheering them, not thinking, wait, that scene's over already?
Derek, quickly, do you think the stage was set for a spinoff, which would have a very hard time competing with the Game of Thrones?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, I think HBO is very serious about a spinoff. I mean, when people say they're tired of watching a movie or television franchise, Peter, you notwithstanding, you know, don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do. You know, Game of Thrones has more attention and more viewership than ever. You know, there are people who are saying they're sick of the show, but you certainly can't see that by the number of people watching, by the ratings. So HBO is wise from a business standpoint to work on spinoffs, and they are working now on a prequel.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. May I suggest This Is Us. Thanks so much, Derek.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.